Dick Nixon's time has come. We need him. You and I need him. America needs him. The world needs him. So, Madison Square Garden, away we go.
Television superstar Jackie Gleason introducing a 1968 rally supporting Richard M. Nixon's campaign for the presidency. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, the director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week we will listen to a number of recordings in the matter of Richard M. Nixon, the 37th President of the United States. Before we get to Pacifica's rendering of the Nixon Oval Office tapes featuring Harry Shearer, Rob Reiner, and Cass Elliot, yes, I said Cass Elliot, let's step back to 1968, the year Nixon was elected into the White House. It was August 5th through the 8th that the Republicans formally announced Nixon as their candidate, and later that month, the turmoil of the Chicago Democratic National Convention took place. In our examination of the DNC a few weeks ago, we heard the powerful sounds of the streets, the theater of ideas, Black Panther Party Chairman Bobby Seale speaking in Lincoln Park, poet Allen Ginsberg getting tear gassed, Jerry Rubin, Tom Hayden, and the crowds. Pacifica listeners were witness to the events outside the convention hall with an immediacy the television viewers missed. Television's influence on the viewers and on the convention hall floor is the key factor here. The very first broadcast of the conventions was in 1948 when TV was so new, not many Americans owned them. But by 1956, the political parties began to alter the convention program to fit the television audience, or more importantly, the voters. Less debate, more show. Less substance, more control. Then the 1968 DNC happened. Let me quote a paragraph from an article from the Museum of Broadcasting Media, penned by Sharon Jarvis. At times, no one is able to control the conventions. Political officials and network executives and technicians alike are caught up in events beyond their control. This was certainly the case in the 1968 Democratic Convention, perhaps the most famous of all televised events of this sort. On that occasion, anti-war protesters demonstrated outside the Chicago Convention Center, drawing down the wrath of the Chicago police. Inside, the conflict was reflected in charges and countercharges, name-calling and recrimination. Much of this activity was caught on camera, but the sense was that even the TV cameras were reacting rather than controlling. Few conventions since that time have been so dramatically bound to television, and most are tightly controlled events exhibiting small moments of spontaneity. So this brings us to our first excerpt from the Pacifica Radio Archives vault. The pro-Nixon rally, Madison Square Garden, New York City, October 31st, 1968. What Pacifica listeners heard that the television audience did not hear or see were the instructions to the delegates as if they were extras on a movie set. As you listen to the warm-up speaker, realize that these were never meant to be heard by the viewers.
It's coming up to about 2.5 minutes to airtime. Now, let's take that check one time now. I want to hear the applause. On the show, we just don't dilly-dally like that. And others of you are sitting around, you applaud like this, you know, like a hippie being real. But you don't do that. Some of you stand around like this when you're on camera, you know, at those other rallies. We do a dignified one, and when we applaud, we smile because we're on television, and we smile with enthusiasm like this when we're doing it. That's how. Now, let me hear it on a three count. Pull out all the stops. One, two, three.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jackie Gleason. I love this country. It's been good to me, beyond my wildest dreams. And because I love America so much, lately I've been concerned. Like a lot of you, concerned about where America is going in the next 4 years. That's why I've decided to speak up for Richard Nixon. He sees it like it is, and he tells it like it is. I've never made a public choice like this before, but I think our country needs Dick Nixon, and we need him now. I think we'll all feel a lot safer with him in the White House. In the next hour, you're going to see him, hear him speak, listen to him. Make up your own mind. Never mind what everybody else tells you he says. Listen to him say it yourself. And see if you don't agree with me. Dick Nixon's time has come. We need him. You and I need him. America needs him. The world needs him. So, Madison Square Garden, away we go.
That was television icon Jackie Gleason in the opening of the October 31st, 1968 televised rally supporting Richard M. Nixon in his run for the President of the United States. After Richard M. Nixon won the election in November of 1968, the world continued to spin out of control. In this next segment, Pacifica programmers Neil Conan and Paul Fisher produced a report that brought the experience of insiders and outsiders to the listeners. On December 9, 1969, almost a year after his inauguration, President Nixon began his day in the early morning with the expected meetings and phone calls. At 5 p.m., the president flew from Washington, D.C. to New York City.
Across the street from me is the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, where tonight President Nixon is accepting an award and giving a speech. Is a scheduled demonstration, which should begin at around 5 o'clock. It's about 4 o'clock now. Took a walk around the area just as I got here, and this is the scene. There are a few demonstrators here already. They are mostly passing out leaflets. They appear to be workers for the Fifth Avenue Peace Parade Committee.
By 6:23, he was in his suite 35A at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
Free body of bench spread! 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 Free body of bench spread!
At 7:01, the president left his room and was escorted to the Grand Ballroom by the president and vice president of the National Football Foundation to attend the Hall of Fame dinner. The dinner lasted until 10:41, but not before President Nixon was presented the foundation's Gold Medal Award.
I simply want to set the record straight with regard to my football qualifications as far as the... This is a candid, open administration. We believe in telling the truth about football and everything. I can only say that as far as this award is concerned, that it's certainly a small step for the National Football Foundation and a small step for football, but it's a giant leap for a man who never even made the team at Whittier.
That was what was going on inside the hotel. Pacifica listeners got to hear what was going on outside the hotel as well. Here, then, is a portion of Halftime Show, a recording of the events of December 9th, 1969.
The main entrance of the Waldorfs, shouting at the press, mostly, who's standing here, and the people who staying at the Waldorf. Police have done nothing as yet, but here they come. Here come the police. They're moving the demonstrators away. The police are pushing the demonstrators. Then somebody has just calmed. One of the police captains has just calmed the police down. They were pushing rather violently for a while, but very short time, but they've stopped and they're moving in a disorderly but fairly peaceful fashion back down to 49th Street.
I didn't hear the Whittier song either a moment ago. In fact, only the coach from Loyola knows where Whittier is. We used to play Loyola. I got into a game once when we were so far behind it didn't matter. I even got into one against Southern Cal once when we were so far behind it didn't matter. Now, just to tell you a little about Whittier, if I may, because I want the record to be straight, it's a school with very high academic standing.
Marches.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
Moving west on 48th Street now. A lot of people joining in. Can hear them shouting, "Let's go!
Let's go! Let's go!"
Might as well go with them and see what happens.
We have a very remarkable coach, and today, as we pay tribute to the players, I'm glad that one of those who made the Hall of Fame is a coach, Bud Wilkinson. I pointed out in my acceptance address at Miami that one of the men who influenced me most in my life was my coach, and I think that could be true of many public men. My coach is an American Indian, Chief Newman. He was a perfectly remarkable man and a great leader. And I learned more from him about life, really, than I did about football. But a little about football. One of the reasons I guess he didn't put me in is that I didn't know the plays. Now, there was a good reason for that. It wasn't because I wasn't smart enough. I knew the enemy's plays. I played them all week long.
It's the General Mealy. They're just running down here. There's no tear gas.
Believe me, nobody in the Southern California Conference knew Occidentals or Pomonas or Redlands or Caltechs or Loyola's plays better than I did because I was on that side. And I learned a lot sitting by the coach on the bench. Sitting by the coach, learned about football, learned about life.
So we're just running down 50th Street. The police are chasing the demonstrators. They're clubbing them. And we're not keeping up with them, most of them. We're coming back to Madison Avenue now.
Now let's move forward to the Watergate scandal, 1974. Get ready because this is not as boring as it sounds. You will hear the voices of Harry Shearer, Rob Reiner, and a rare recording of Cass Elliot, better known as Mama Cass from the Mamas and the Papas, reading from the Nixon tapes.
Abraham Lincoln said, "I do the very best I know how, the very best I can, and I mean to keep doing so until the end."
Impeachment alert. Conversation with the President. Live dramatic readings of the Nixon Watergate transcripts as released by the President on Impeachment Alert.
If the end brings me out wrong, 10 angels swearing I was right would make no difference.
Here's 1974 KPFK program director to introduce the piece.
Next, we're going to hear the meeting of April 14th. The part of Richard Nixon will be read by Christopher Guest. The part of H.R. Bob Haldeman, which will be read by Peter Boyle. But first, a word of explanation. When the transcript indicates that an expletive has been deleted, you will hear this electronic beep. Two beeps indicate a deletion of a characterization. Three beeps indicate material deleted as not relevant by the president's staff. Unintelligible or inaudible material will be indicated by a rushing sound or white noise. Our actors will now introduce themselves and indicate the parts they will be reading.
Christopher Guest, President Nixon.
Peter Boyle, H.R. Bob Haldeman.
And now for the meeting that took place on April 14th at 1:55, we go to the Oval Office. The first voice you hear is that of the president.
Has anything come out yet? Something implies that there are copies of a bill from the Watergate to the White House or not, or has that not been said? He could have had, but I suppose not.
I am sure that it is the thing that follows. All of them had access to everything. Involvement, implication is clearly there.
Everybody is sure trying to get in the act now. I see a message here from Steve that John had thought about the Watergate and had some ideas he would like to pass along.
Impeachment Alert, Special Edition. Conversations with the President. Live dramatic readings of the Nixon Watergate transcripts as released by the President.
Next, the meeting with the President and John Dean takes place in the Oval Office on March 17th, 1973. This is material relating to the break-in at Dr. Fielding's office in California. The part of the president will be read by Harry Shearer, and the part of John Dean will be read by Mike Hodell. Okay, and now we go direct to the Oval Office at 1:25 in the afternoon concerning material relating to the break-in at Dr. Fielding's office in California. The president speaks first.
Now, on the Segretti thing, I think you've just got to tape it. All of them have just got to take the heat. Look, you've got to admit the facts, John. And
that's right.
And that's our... And that's that. And Kalmbach paid him, and a lot of people. I just think on Segretti, no matter how bad it isn't nearly as bad as people think it was. Espionage, sabotage.
The intent when Segretti was hired was nothing evil, nothing vicious, nothing bad, nothing not espionage, not sabotage. It was pranksterism that got out of hand, and we know that. and I think we can lay our story out there. I have no problem with the Segretti thing. It's just not that serious. The other potential problem is Ehrlichman's, and this
In connection with Hunt?
In connection with Hunt and Liddy both.
They worked for it.
These fellows had to be some idiots, as we've learned after the fact. They went out and went into Dr. Ellsberg's doctor's office, and they were geared up with all the CIA equipment, cameras and the like. Well, they turned the stuff back into the CIA some point in time and left film in the camera. CIA has not put this together, and they don't know what it all means right now. But it wouldn't take a very sharp investigator very long, because you've got pictures in the CIA files that they had to turn over.
What in the world? What in the name of God was Ehrlichman having something in the Ellsberg...
They were trying to... This was part of an operation that, in connection with the Pentagon Papers. They were... The whole thing. They wanted to get Ellsberg's psychiatric records for some reason. I don't know.
Well, this is the first I ever heard of this. I... Air about Ellsberg was not our problem.
That's right.
Well...
Well, anyway... It was under an Ehrlichman structure. Maybe John didn't even know. I've never asked him if he knew. I didn't want to know.
Well, I can't see that getting into this hearing.
Well, look. No, here's the way it can come up.
Yeah.
In the CIA's files, which the committee is asking for, the material they turned over to the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
They are all the materials relating to Hunt in there are these pictures which the CIA developed. They've got Gordon Liddy standing proud as punch outside this doctor's office with his name on it. And this material's not going to take very long for an investigator to go back and say, well, why would this somebody be at the doctor's office? And they'd find out that there was a break-in at the doctor's office, and then you'd find Liddy on the staff, and then you'd start working back. I don't think they'll ever reach that point.
It's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant, right.
That's the point. That's where Irvin's rules of relevancy.
And that short meeting, the meeting between the president and Dean in the Oval Office on March 17, 1973.
You have been listening to the Nixon Tapes as presented by KPFK in 1974. For a copy of this program or for more information, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us at the Pacifica Radio Archives, 1-800-735-0230.
Do you remember your President Nixon? Do you remember the bills you have to pay?
We now come to the eve of the celebrated March 21st conversation between Nixon and Dean. In today's nomination hearings, L. Patrick Gray has revealed that he is now under orders from Attorney General Kleindienst to tell the committee nothing about the Watergate investigation. Gray pleads with the committee to vote on his nomination and let him get out of the, quote, minefield separating the Congress and the administration. The committee declines, voting to broaden its inquiry. The senators subpoena Judith Hoback, a former employee of CREEP, Thomas Bishop, former assistant director of the FBI, and Thomas Lombard, a former lawyer with the Justice and Treasury Departments. Lombard has linked Dean with Gordon Liddy. Bishop is known to have ordered FBI offices to give CREEP information helpful to Nixon. The president calls Dean to discuss the subpoenas.
And now here is President Nixon, as played by Harry Shearer, and John Dean, as played by Mike Hodel, in the telephone conversation, the president with John Dean on March 20th, 1973. This is at approximately 7:29 p.m. in the evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
You're having rather long days these days, aren't you? I guess we all have.
I think they will continue to be longer. The other witnesses they have now subpoenaed. There are two other witnesses. There's a Hoback girl from the re-election committee. She was interrogated by committee staff and counsel as a result of her confidential interviews with the FBI.
Huh.
The Hoback girl should be broken down. She should come out in tears as a result of the fact that she's virtually lying about one thing and our people will be...
You mean, do our people know what to ask her?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Uh-huh. Why is she doing it? Do we know?
She,
Disgruntled. Somebody...
Disgruntled. She's been fairly disgruntled all along. She's a Democrat that worked over there in finance committee. She professes a personal loyalty to Maury Stans, but that is about the extent of it in any of her loyalty.
Yeah.
I have never figured out how she got in there.
They didn't bite the bullet with regard to subpoenaing you?
No, I don't think there's any chance they're going to do that.
It's rather interesting, isn't it? Something ought to be made of that.
Unless they get... They are taking more evidence on me. Obviously, with these other two witnesses. Not that I think anything will come out of this. It will just be more... I had a conversation with John Ehrlichman this afternoon before he came down to visit you. I think that one thing that we have to continue to do, and particularly right now, is to examine the broadest implications of this whole thing. And, you know, maybe about 30 minutes of just my recitation to you of facts so that you operate from the same facts that everybody else has.
Right.
I don't think... We've never really done that. It's been sort of bits and pieces. Just paint the whole picture for you, the soft spots, the potential problem areas, and the like, so that when you make judgments, you will have all that information.
Would you like to do that? When?
I would think, if it's not inconvenient for you, sir, I would like to sort of draw my thoughts together and have a... just make some notes to myself, so I didn't...
Could you do it tomorrow?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. All right, well, then we can probably do it, say, around 10 o'clock?
That would be fine, sir.
Do you just want to do it alone? Want anybody else there?
I think just...
It's better with nobody else there, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Anybody else are all partisan interest, virtually?
That's right.
Right, fine. The other thing I was going to say, just is this, just for your own thinking, I still want to see, though I guess you and Dick are still working on your letter and all that sort of thing.
We are, and we are coming to... The more we work on it, the more questions we see.
That you don't want to answer, huh?
That bring problems by answering.
And so you're coming up, then, with the idea of just being just a stone wall, then, is that...
That's right.
Is that what you come down with?
Stone wall with lots of noises that we are always willing to cooperate, but no one is asking us for anything.
And they never will, huh? There's no way that you could make even a general statement that I could put out. You understand what I...
I think we could.
See, for example, I was even thinking that if you could... Even talk to cabinet, the leaders, you know, just orally and say, I've looked into this and this is that, so that people get sort of a feeling that your own people have got to be reassured. Could you do that?
Well, I think I can, but I don't think you'd want to make that decision until we have a...
No, I want to know. I want to know where all the bodies are first.
And then once you decide after that, we can program it any way you want to do it.
Yeah, because I think... For example, you could do it orally, even if you don't want to make the written statement. You could do it orally before the cabinet, the leaders, and the rest. Lay it all out. You see, I would not be present. You just lay it all out, and I just... See what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Now, that's one thing. The other thing is that I do think there's something to be said for... not maybe this complete answer to this fella, but maybe just a statement to me. My versions of these. Bing, bing, bing. That's a possibility.
Uh-huh.
What I mean is... We need something to answer somebody. Answer things. You know, they say, what are you basing this on? I can say, well, my counsel has advised me that... Is that possible or not? Or are...
Well, you know, there is that, and there is always the FBI report, which we have probably not relied upon enough. There is not one scintilla of evidence.
I know. But, I mean, can't you say that, or do you want to put it out?
It could be said, and it is something we haven't really emphasized. Pat Gray is the only person who has said it and has never really gotten picked up.
How would you do it, then? What I meant, isn't that something you could say? Do you want to publish the FBI report?
Oh, no, because at our own strictures, we are trying to place an upright...
But you could say, I have this and this is that. Fine. See, what I'm getting at is that if apart from a statement to the committee or anything else, if you could just make a statement to me that we can use, you know, for internal purposes and to answer questions, etc.
As we did when you, back in August, made the statement...
That's right.
And all the things...
You've got to have something where it doesn't appear that I'm doing this in, you know, just a... Saying to hell with the Congress and to hell with the people. We're not going to tell you anything because of executive privilege. That they don't understand. But if you say no, we're willing to cooperate. And you've made a complete statement, but make it very incomplete. See, that's what I mean. I don't want it too much in chapter and verse as you did in your letter. I just want a general...
An all-around statement.
That's right. Try just something general, like... I've checked into this matter. I can categorically, based on my investigation, the following. Haldeman is not involved in this, that, and the other thing. Mr. Colson did not do this. Mr. So-and-so did not do this. Mr. Blank did not do this. Right down the line, taking the most glaring things. If there are any further questions, please let me know. See?
I think we can do that.
That's one possibility. And then you could say that such things, and then use the FBI report to the cabinet and to the leaders. It just might be very salutary. See, our own people have got to have confidence or they're not going to step up and defend us. You see our problem there, don't you?
And I think at the same time, it'll be good to brief these people on what executive privilege means so they can go out and speak about it. Some of them are flying.
And why it's necessary.
I thought about having someone prepare some material that can be put out by the congressional people so they can understand. People can understand. It is tremendous to have a piece of paper that they know they can talk from.
Pointing out that you're defending the Constitution, responsibility of the separation of powers, and we have to do it. Distinguishing the Adams case, ignoring Flanagan, which is one we should never have agreed to, but nevertheless... Well, anyway, let's think a little about that, but we'll... We'll see you at 10 o'clock tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
Fine.
All right, sir. Good night.
Take the evening off.
All right.
And that, a conversation, a telephone conversation at that, taking place between the president and John Dean on March 20th, 1973. The part of Nixon was read by...
Harry Shearer.
And the part of John Dean...
By Mike Hodel.
Next, meeting between the president, H.R. Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, and Ron Ziegler... In the Oval Office on April 17, 1973, at 12:35 p.m., our actors will now introduce themselves and indicate the parts they will be playing.
Hi, I'm Rob Reiner. I'll be playing Ehrlichman.
I am Eugene Trubnik, and I'll be playing Mr. Nixon.
I'm Cass Elliott, and I'll be playing Haldeman.
And now for the meeting that took place on April 17th at 12:35 in the afternoon in the Oval Office. The first voice you hear is that of the president.
Go ahead. Go ahead on the action.
Well, it would involve the suspension because it would involve a recounting of how you happened to get into that personal investigation of this by reason of Deans being unable to reduce his full report to you, to writing for you. And that rang a bell. You personally turned to and have spent a great deal of your time in the last several weeks on this and have seen dramatic progress in the grand jury in the last several days. That would be step one. And now, in addition to that, you would say that the Irvin Committee has come up with a good set of ground rules which do provide...
Well, did you work that out?
Well, you'd say this. I think you'll find that they are going to go on a television under oath, pretty much regardless, but the ground rules give you a toehold. They do provide for executive session.
Well, is executive session considered executive privilege?
And they will consider...
And otherwise they'll go into open hearings?
Yes, but there again, executive privilege is reserved.
Oh, executive privilege is reserved. Fine.
At this point, the way we're in the soup now, we can lose nothing by going.
That's right.
I think we may gain.
That's right. I couldn't agree more. So if you can prepare me with at least that much, I'll agree. That I can say that today.
Well, that's a hell of a bomb shelter right there.
Yes, it is. But let's get on with the rest of it.
That's right. That's all I have for today. But it gets you into the case. It's you leading it. It notices the progress in the grand jury is related to your efforts, and it doesn't say what they are.
Well, the point is, through the story today, is that John Dean is suspended. But, and then John Dean is going to be out there plastering, out saying the president has indicated that Haldeman and Ehrlichman and two might go.
Let me suggest a different process, which is that you don't suspend Dean, but that you instruct John Dean that he is not to come to work anymore. He is in effect suspended, but not publicly suspended.
Well, he'll say, what about Haldeman and Ehrlichman?
Well, I would suggest to you that you do the same with us. And I was going to suggest, I was going to request that action. For this reason, I got to speak for myself. John's got to speak for himself. I have now concluded that my course is that I must put out my story. I must put it out in total and in my words before I go to the... I don't know about the grand jury. Before I...
Before you go to the Senate committee.
Go to the Senate committee.
You have been listening to the Nixon Tapes as presented by KPFK in 1974. And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault. For a copy of this program or for more information, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us at the Pacifica Radio Archives, 1-800-735-0230. The series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. We'd like to thank Lucia Chappell for helping us investigate the White House tapes and the good folks in the archives at the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening.